This this is the fifth day of this October 2010 seven-day session. We'll resume reading from the talks of Japanese Zen Master Basui from a book called Mud and Water, translated by Arthur Braverman. I've skipped a lot of material in here that I don't feel is suitable for Teisho. A lot of stuff about I won't go into it. Just it's just not the best for Sesshin Teisho, certainly. Here a questioner asks, it is said that when looking at the sayings and teachings of the Buddhas and patriarchs, if you look as one with fresh hatred looks upon an enemy, you will then, for the first time, be able to understand them. What do you think about this? Looking as one with fresh hatred looks upon an enemy. Perhaps the saying means to look with fierce, unwavering attention and determination. Let's see what Basui says. The way is a fundamental part of everybody. That's bears repeating. The way is a fundamental part of everybody. Its essence is to penetrate enlightenment and to leave no trace of this attainment. Notice, it's not just to penetrate enlightenment, but he says, and then to leave no trace of this attainment. Meaning, of course, no thought. No self-conscious awareness of having attained anything. If I were to explain this fundamental part, even the one word awaken would add waves to a level surface. How much more so with sayings and teachings? One who holds on to the residue and cannot grasp the real cuts himself off from the source in the end. So maybe the saying to look as one with fresh hatred looks upon an enemy is to means to look. To want to have nothing to do with. But Basui often mentions the koans in his text. We've read some of that, and he worked on them himself, many of them. So anyway, we'll just go on. Buddha nature, the self of all beings, is the simple truth as it is. It transcends sects and rules. Even the Buddhas of the three worlds, past, present, and future, can't explain it. It's beyond explanations. No explanation can begin to encompass this mind. The commentaries on the treasury of the teachings discussed during the lifetime of the Buddha can't catch hold of it either. Its full function has no equal. The speed of a flint spark can't compare with it. Lightning can't even penetrate it. Its activity has no fixed direction. Thinking it is rising in the east, it sinks west. Thinking it is rising in the south, it sinks in the north. It makes thunder roar in clear, fine weather, and flames arise at the bottom of the sea. These statements, Basui, these illogical statements, is a classic Zen way of expressing in words what can't be expressed in words. pointing to what is far beyond the understanding of our rational minds. If we could understand it with our rational minds, then it would be a thing, an it. It is the master of seeing, hearing, and perceiving, and the master that raises the hands and propels the legs. From the Buddhas and patriarchs down to insects, of all things that possess essential nature, who would not receive its favor? What of you people? Do you know yourselves? When you doubt sufficiently, your enlightenment will be sufficient. Doubt here means question or wonder. If you wonder about this enough, your enlightenment, it will be enough. When you have true aspiration, even if you don't want to doubt, your whole body will be filled with doubt. Even if you don't seek expedient practices, your mind will not busy itself with miscellany. So just a comment on that. When you have true aspiration, even if you don't want to question this mind, your whole body will be filled with questioning. Though you don't want to eliminate them, you will be rid of the 10,000 things. This is the state of radical simplicity that the mind reaches when it has this one great matter before it. One matter, not many matters. Your mind will not busy itself with miscellany. How many people hearing this can say that their minds don't busy with miscellany? By miscellany, we could take this to mean unnecessary things. People sometimes ask me, what can I do to prepare for Sesshin, or just what can I do to deepen my practice besides sitting? And well, of course, sitting is always the central thing, but the other thing is to find ways to simplify your life. Find ways to take the clutter out of it. Find ways to strip away the non-essentials. All the time you spend at the computer, unnecessarily, unrelated to your work, surfing websites, stripping away the concern about everything that traipses across TV, radio, blogs. To understand that this is a practice, quite simply put, it's a practice of emptying the mind. And the more we fill it up with this stuff, the more we're working at cross purposes with our underlying aspiration. not saying to try to lead the life of a monk, but at least cut down on these things. Though you don't want to eliminate them, you would be rid of the 10,000 things. Though you don't choose to discard them, reading sutras and commentaries and all kinds of activities will naturally be eliminated. Profit and loss, good and bad, all will be obliterated. That, of course, that means concerns about profit and loss. Well, if there ever was a time for us to absorb that advice, it's now, in these very uncertain, shaky economic times. How many people just torment themselves worrying about their stock portfolio or IRA? Notice the emphasis here is on how these things, when one's practice is really grounded seriously in daily zazen, how these things will just fall away on their own. You don't have to make a great exertion of will not to spend all of the time, free time you have at the computer. You lose interest in it if you're doing enough sitting, or if you have enough doubt, enough of a need to know. And notice with the reading, so far in this whole book, from what we've read, all he mentions about reading is sutras and commentaries. What do you think he would say about all the other stuff that people read all the time? All the garbage, all the unnecessary stuff that just clogs up the mind. Again, the emphasis on the sitting first, rather than making a battle out of things that you want to eliminate in your life. Sit. And these things lose their, or tend to anyway, things tend to lose their allure, their appeal. I've noticed that when I've tried to read something right after a 7-day sesshin, it's just so, feels so weird to be. Looking at this little marks of ink on paper, so it's so dead compared to just the direct experience. Our mind is so freshened by sesshin. We come out with a mind so wide and open and clean and vibrant. It just feels strange to sit in front of a page and read something. It took some adjustment when I became a teacher and started giving teishos and to get used to that. But then what you have to do, you do. And then you become one with that. You do it with an undivided mind. Like one who is stricken with a severe illness and is about to die, whose mind doesn't distinguish friends from enemies, when you travel, you will forget you are walking. When you are eating, you will be unaware of the taste. When you are sitting, you will forget you are sitting. Forgetting your body, you will not lie down. If in this way you become a part of this doubt, in a short time, you will inevitably experience great enlightenment. Well, here he's describing someone in a very, very advanced state of samadhi, of absorption. When you're eating, you'll be unaware of the taste. When you're sitting, you will forget you're sitting. Forgetting your body, you will not lie down. This is quite rare, but not unheard of, even today. Sometimes people come to Dzogchen and ask whether they should strive in their sitting, whether they should strive to keep the mind open and hear every sound. This question comes out of the sense that, after all, we want to come into harmony with our big mind and not shut out anything. But I always say, well, that can happen when you're sitting and you're getting very absorbed. You can suddenly be as acutely aware of the tiniest sound in the room or outside. It's quite a wonderful state. But don't think that that's supposed to happen. And Basui here is pointing out another kind of strong practice, is where you lose awareness of things around you. A Chinese master said, "One who is truly working on Mu does not see the ground when he lowers his head and does not see the sky when he raises it." There are those who might think, well, what kind of a way to live is that, where we're just in this cocoon of Mu or concentration and we're shut out the rest of the world? Well, it doesn't last very long. That's a very unusual and transitory state. And our job isn't to judge it in any case, whether it's good or bad. The best thing is not to have any notions in the mind about what's supposed to be happening when we get deep into our practice. And he quotes an ancient, see if it says who it is, the footnote. Nope, doesn't say. An ancient said, "To care for this matter as your own, be like one who, passing through a village which has been infected with destructive rice worms, you will not even wet his throat with a drop of water. Then you will attain it." Not the most contemporary analogy. "Thus, if you want enlightenment, abandon to its depths all ordinary attachment to deeds and behavior, principles and obligations, opinions and interpretations. Be as before the birth of your mother and father, separate from all external phenomena, neither sinking into internal quiet nor settling in the void. Look directly. Now, as you are listening, tell me, what is it that listens?" Zen Master Rinzai said, "This physical body of yours, composed of the four great elements, can't hear the Dharma. Your spleen, stomach, liver, and gallbladder can't hear the Dharma. the empty sky can't hear the Dharma, then what does hear it? And then a new topic here, where Basui addresses the discriminating mind. Now, a little forward, before we get into this, there's always this problem of how to refer to this mind with a small m. Some translators just render it as ego. The problem with the word ego is that it so easily becomes a thing to us, a devilish thing. You might as well say Lucifer as the ego. It's just our conditioning. We hear that and we think of it as some kind of discrete thing, an agent, that is our enemy. And that's a limited, it gives us lots of trouble, but when we make a thing out of it, an enemy, then we're stuck with that concept. That's why I use that word less and less. Here the translator chooses the conscious mind. He refers to this as the conscious mind. The problem with that one is that it almost implies, okay, we don't want the conscious mind, we want the unconscious mind, which is misleading, of course. We don't want to be unconscious. We just want to reach mind, this mind, this fundamental mind that is greater than the conscious or the unconscious. So I'm going to refer to this as the discriminating mind. Even that, there's a problem with discrimination. We discriminate all the time. We have to. We make all kinds of discriminations. Every other than in zazen, we're constantly discriminating. We need to. We have to discriminate between when it rains, so we can know how to dress properly. Of course, in this session, we haven't had to discriminate much. It's been all rain, pretty much, until now. But we have to discriminate between the apple we eat and the napkins that are next to it. We have to discriminate when we're driving between turning left and turning right. This is a natural function that we use all the time. There's nothing wrong with discriminating when it's called for. The problem is that we can't seem to turn off this engine mind of discrimination. It just keeps running and running and running when we don't need it, such as during zazen. So, although the translator uses the phrase conscious mind throughout this, I'm going to say discriminating mind, or just mind, small m mind. Questioner, I hear that all the successive ancestors point directly to people's minds, causing them to look into their inherent nature and attain Buddhahood. I also hear that looking at one's self is as intense as hatred for an enemy. What is the meaning of this? Basui, in the self, there are the true and the false. The discriminating mind is the false. Buddha nature is the true. When you awaken to your true nature, you cut off the roots of the wheel of transmigration, manifest your many inherent virtues, and make contact with others, bringing benefit to their lives. This is seeing into your inherent nature and attaining Buddhahood. The root of life and death is the discriminating mind. The cause of our sorrow is ego delusion. Beginning practitioners mistakenly take things like the emission of light and the performance of miracles, which are really the roots of ignorance, for the clear expression of Buddha nature. An ancient said, students of the way don't realize the truth because they dwell on the discriminating mind of the past. Or another phrase would be the conditioned mind. Maybe that's even better, the conditioned mind. The seed of birth and death through endless eons is what fools call the true original self. So this is the inherent delusion, is when we identify with this conditioned mind, this discriminating mind, and think that that's the whole picture. What we find is it's the smallest part of mind. Yasutani Roshi once at an introductory lecture, he held up a ballpoint pen. He said, if this pen were to represent our true mind, our conditioned mind is no more than the tip, the little ball at the end of the pen. This conscious mind, this conditioned mind, is the boss of notorious robbers, the origin of the 10 evil deeds, and the pit of knowledge based on attachment to form. If it is not destroyed, though you were to speak wonderful words of the miraculous, they would all be no more than strange spirits of wild foxes. In the end, you wouldn't be able to avoid floating in the world of transmigration. It is endlessly circling through lifetime after lifetime, suffering and suffering and suffering. That's why its destruction is connected with the one great matter. Destruction, again, remember, always means is to see through. There's nothing we need to destroy, because there's nothing apart from us, nothing outside us to menace us. We just need to see the illusory nature of this conditioned mind and see what a tiny fragment it is of our true mind. The reason for transmigration through the six realms of existence, from the beginningless beginning to the present, tossing and turning in great pain, is that you can't turn off this conditioned mind. The tree of swords and the mountain of blades are born of it. Here he gets into some standard issue Buddhist hells from popular Buddhism. The tree of swords and the mountain of blades, the boiling kiln and burning coal come from it also. The demons and devils, too, come from nowhere else. The beast with hair and horns is no other than a product of this conditioned mind. Though there are new heads and different faces, some dying here and being reborn there, though there may be retribution from various results of causes, some becoming beautiful and some becoming ugly, all are a result of nothing other than this conditioned mind. This habit force, this karma. Though it is said never to have form, it is like fire, which kindles flame in firewood when the proper contact is made. If this contact no longer exists, quiet sets in. When it moves, It is like clouds and mist appearing. That is, when the conditioned mind moves, it is like clouds and mist appearing. When it is under control, it is like the clear blue sky. As long as practitioners of the way haven't eradicated their conditioned minds, all their activities and words are the deeds of karmic consciousness. They are not in accord with the way. Whether they are bright or dull, knowledgeable or ignorant, thoughtful or thoughtless, with or without desires, whether they use expedient means or study the direct teachings, whether they are venerated or held in contempt, whether they perform miracles and have feelings of love and pity, these are, after all, activities of the conditioned mind, the discriminating mind. When it is cold, all heaven and earth are cold. When it is hot, all heaven and earth are hot. When there is justice, everything is just. When there is evil, everything is evil. When you stop the movement of the discriminating mind and realize the way of no mind, whether you practice rightly or wrongly, speak or remain silent, are active or quiet, the I is not never there. All is the turning of the right Dharma wheel. From the outset, there has never been evil and good with regard to the Dharma. Evil and good simply exist when you are trying to destroy the discriminating mind, and you still haven't done so. This is our tendency to judge what's happening in the mind. This very deep affliction. An obstacle that really wreaks havoc with so many people's practice is applying these discriminations to what's going on in the mind. If you clearly eliminate the drunken mind, drunken rages will instantly stop and mind and body will be calm and quiet. A drunken mind we could render as the blind passions that so often get the better of us. If you want to recover completely from your illness, then stay free when sitting, lying down, and when doing walking meditation, and don't rely on another's power. Just stop your wandering. Look penetratingly into your inherent nature and, concentrating your spiritual energy, sit in Zazen and break through to the true self. Then you will, for the first time, attain liberation. If you simply try to stop the movement of consciousness and consider this enlightenment, it will be like searching for a fish, considering it a jewel, or searching after a robber and treating him as your child. This will put an iron wall between you and enlightenment. It will be a hateful traitor damaging the Dharma treasure. You know, the example of a robber or a bandit is used so much in the old texts. Poverty was so widespread throughout much of Buddhist history, and you can see why this among the various crimes might be mentioned so often. Questioner, today I realized for the first time that all these years I've been searching after a robber and treating him as my child. Though I may see my mistake, if I do not actually destroy this conditioned mind myself, the moment of liberation will never arrive. With what expedient means will I rid myself of it? Expedient means a method. In Zen, it would mean any method other than Zazen, or being fully present at any given moment. Basui, there is no particular expedient means. If you just detach from all forms in your mind and don't fall into the pit of formlessness, liberation will manifest in your body as it is right now. The high priest, the Zen master Mumon, said, to obey the regulations and keep the rules is to tie yourself with a rope. Arbitrary selfishness is heresy and devilry. Becoming settled and quiet while the mind exists is the heretical Zen of silent illumination. Doing as you will, neglecting relationships, you fall into the deep pit of liberation. To be clever and clear-headed is to be tied in chains, to be bound in shackles. To think of good and bad is to dwell in the temples of heaven and hell. Fixed views of the Buddha and Dharma enclose you in the two iron mountains. Mythical illusion, the two iron mountains. One who has an instant awakening from an arising thought is sporting with spirits. Meditation in complete stillness is an activity of the devil. When you advance, you are deluded by Buddhist principles. When you retreat, you act contrary to Buddhist principles. When you can neither advance nor retreat, you are a breathing corpse. Now, how on earth can you practice this after all? This is full of contradictions. Mumon's words are very famous. This appears in the Mumonkan as an extra supplemental text. The best thing with this is not to try to reason it out and puzzle over these contradictory things that he's saying. His point, of course, is to get rid of all notions you have about all notions you have there. Just blow them out of your mind. Some of the worst are the ideas that we accumulate about Zen and Buddhism, the Dharma, truth, reality, true nature. Blah! Tony Mu! What is it? Who is dwelling in these concepts? He's really holding up discrimination as the problem. We get attached to our discriminations. If you practice and realize this, he continues, now in this way, you will comprehend the great matter of life and death. If, however, you become obstructed by the theory and do not penetrate the gate of the patriarchs, you will sink in the sea of delusion through eternity. This is why the ancients, arousing their fearless aspiration, spent 20, 30, 40 years, even their whole lives, refraining from lying down, forgetting to sleep or eat, practicing single-mindedly, applying spiritual energy in response to the occasion, looking penetratingly into their own nature, and hence realizing the light of their own spiritual essence. All karmic hindrances are founded in this discriminating mind, this conditioned mind, and this so-called conditioned mind is founded in Buddha nature. There are some people, when they hear descriptions of these great spiritual titans who spent 20, 30, 40 years refraining from lying down, forgetting to eat or sleep, and so forth, they make the mistake of comparing themselves to these guys. There's the discrimination right there. Comparing and then finding oneself wanting, deficient. Oh, look at that. What hope is there for me when you read about those guys, what they could do? The worst thing is when one then takes a defeatist posture. What hope is there for me? It's just the complete wrong thing to do. These guys who spent all this time, who made such tremendous, arduous efforts, didn't start that way. Those are spiritual muscles they developed, starting much more modestly, just stretching, pushing a little further, a little further. Staying up a little longer than they might want to. I think our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.